Hello, my name is Marcus Speller from The Football Ramble, and welcome to The Mixer Podcast. This is the penultimate episode in an eight-part series to coincide with the release of The Mixer, a book written by one of our panellists, Michael Cox. The Mixer, the story of the Premier League's tactics from Route 1 to False Nines, is out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. Michael, you're with us, and it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Marcus.
And we're joined once again by The Telegraph's Adam Hurry, responsible for the fantastic Football Clichés book. Hi, Adam.
Hi, guys.
Good to have you with us as well. Today, we're looking at centre-forwards. Michael, this is another role that has changed significantly over the past 25 years.
Yeah, I'd say that broadly speaking, there's been three types of classic Premier League striker. I think in the early years, it was all about the target men. You had your Duncan Ferguson, Chris Sutton, Dion Dublin types, who were primarily very good in the air, probably not going to harm you running in behind. You then had a shift towards much quicker players like Nicolas Anelka, Michael Owen, Thierry Henry, of course. And then, you know, maybe most famously, you've had the false nine in recent years, popularised outside the Premier League by Leo Messi. And you had lots of teams try to copy that across Europe with mixed success. But again, it's been a position where there's been lots of evolution over the course of a relatively short period of time.
And whatever the role of that centre-forward or attacking player furthest up the pitch, goals is one thing that people want to see them getting. And we have the perfect man to explain quite how varied that task is, because, Adam, for your book, you compiled a comprehensive list of how many ways it's possible to score a goal. What was the final figure?
73 in the end, which is, it sounds about right to me, because it's the most fundamental act in football. So there should, you know, so many ways of describing how to put the ball in the back of the net.
It's a great number, 73. It's not 10. It's not 25, not even 50, 73.
Absolutely. It makes it sound like I put research into it. Yeah, if I went to a round figure, people would just assume I made it up.
Yeah, did you get this? You got to 73 and thought that's enough?
Yes.
Of course not. Michael, who was the Premier League's first great centre-forward in your opinion?
Well, I think Alan Shearer was obviously the man who, throughout the mid-90s and indeed a little bit after that, was just... yeah, I mean, he was at one point the most expensive player in the world. You can't underestimate quite how good he was. And I think he's an interesting player because, again, maybe people who came to the Premier League slightly late would think of Shearer as kind of a pure target man, a pure number nine. But you look at his game in the early years for Blackburn, even, you know, for Southampton before the Premier League era, and he was a very quick player, you know, playing on the shoulder, going in behind defences. He was famously also a very good crosser of the ball when he drifted
yeah,
wide.
That's right.
Like, everyone used to say that about him, as if it was like an underrated aspect of his game, whereas it actually was quite fundamental to his game. And, I mean, he was just... incredible player. 260 Premier League goals, still by far and away the most anyone scored. And, you know, it doesn't look like that will be overtaken anytime soon.
In his style changed, Adam, over the years, due to age, but also injury. He got some pretty bad injuries, did Shearer. And as Michael said, you know, he used to run in behind and so on. And some people may think of him as a target man. Often, if a striker is quite strong and can head the ball very well, people will often pigeonhole them as that. But Shearer was possibly the complete forward when you talk about Premier League.
He scored every type of goal. And that was even at the very start of his career. He could get his head on the end of a cross, despite, you know, not being a particularly big guy. But the abiding memory of Shearer in the Premier League, and probably for England, is this kind of bustling number nine who could physically dominate defenders. Not necessarily the, you know, the quicksilver striker of his youth. It is worth speculating what kind of striker he would have turned into if he hadn't had his three really severe injuries, like the ankles and knees. Maybe he wouldn't have been so bulky in his later years. But maybe that worked in his favour, because he ended up reinventing himself gradually as a striker better than anyone I've ever seen. He was physically imposing in his later years and still knew where the goal was, but wasn't necessarily a penalty area striker. I mean, we take that volley against, was it Everton at St James's Park?
Yeah.
And another goal against Chelsea, almost from exactly the same position, where he just absolutely welted it in. So he could still score from 35 yards. He was just doing everything a little bit slower, but slightly harder to stop.
So, he scored all manner of goals, as you say.
Absolutely.
Headers, volleys and everything in between. That change of style as he got older maybe suited some players around him, because playing for that Newcastle side... because he turned down Manchester United twice, of course. Now, had he played at Manchester United with those injuries and that change of style, would he have sort of fitted in? But actually, that Newcastle team, for a more, without sounding reductionist, just traditional kind of forward play, the players around him maybe understood that a bit more and could get the best out of him.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked that Newcastle side when they paired him and Ferdinand for a little bit, just because he had two players who were great in the air, and actually both could spin in behind and were very quick as well. Mm-hmm. But it's quite rare you see two good all-round strikers paired together. Often you'd have one target man and one spinning in behind,
yeah,
or one of those type of players with a number 10. But to have two proper number 9s, in fact, Ferdinand actually had to change his number from 9 to 10. Just that's the extent to which they were literally two number 9s. But yeah, I've really enjoyed watching Newcastle down the years with, you know, and even in the later times when Shearer played alongside Craig Bellamy, I mean, I gather they didn't get on particularly well,
yeah,
off the pitch.
You enjoyed that more than him, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the combination of Shearer then was, you know, a target man by that stage, and Bellamy, who was pure speed, I thought that was a great combination.
Yeah, and we've said the phrase target man a few times. A few more target men from yesteryear: Adam, Chris Sutton, Duncan Ferguson, and Dion Dublin as well. That type of archetypal target man.
I'd say Ferguson and Dublin are the standouts for me in their own different ways. Ferguson was a devastating header of a ball. He attacked the ball like it had done something to his family. Obviously, you wouldn't mess with him. He's one of the very few players to have been imprisoned for something he actually did on the pitch. So Dion Dublin, a lot more artful a striker than he's given credit for. A huge guy, could get his head on most things, but he was an incredibly technically talented guy. But then, of course,
backed up by the fact he could play another position very well indeed.
Go back and play centre half. Yeah. A huge soft spot for strikers. You can go back and play centre half and the opposite direction as well. Because
the English John Charles, if you will, push.
Paul Warhurst.
Oh yeah, another one. Yeah, yeah.
That was the same with Sutton as well. I mean, Chris Sutton started out as a centre back at Norwich, and I remember reading one of the more obscure autobiographies I read was Mike Walker, former Norwich manager, who was saying this was published when he'd just gone to Blackburn. And was saying that Sutton was like wasting his career, and he could be the best centre back in Britain, but he wants to get all the glory by going up front. It's just such a Sunday League way of looking at players' tactical development.
Oh, damn that Premier League winners' medal, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
There are other types of players who you wouldn't say were target men, but they were sort of number nines, if you like, back in the day. Maybe Ian Wright, Andy Cole, Robbie Fowler.
Yeah, I'd personally,
how would you categorise them?
Personally, I'd describe them as kind of pure finishers.
Yeah.
None of those three you'd say were particularly great in the air. They didn't quite have the speed, you know, the kind of athletic speed that came later with Thierry Henry. Mm-hmm. They were all quite quick. But I think that was the kind of era where just being really good at finishing was a guarantee of getting in the side.
Yeah.
And you can contrast that with now, jumping forward about 15 or 20 years, but someone like Daniel Sturridge, who's struggled to get into the Liverpool side because his link play isn't great, his pressing isn't great. He's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, clearly the best finisher Liverpool have. Mm-hmm. But that's no longer enough. And I think that's, you know, real stark contrast with, you know, someone like Robbie Fowler was renowned as, you know, one of the best strikers of that era in the Premier League. Where would his place be in this Liverpool side? I'm not convinced he would be in it.
That is an interesting point. These types of players are often described as sort of relics of football, you know, even in the modern era. And when you say, Michael, that they didn't have the blistering pace, it's true. But whereas Ian Wright was seen as very, very quick. I mean, there's that glorious quote that he once said when describing his entry into the game of football, because obviously he was a late bloomer. And when he was having trials and playing against professional players for the first time, he said, "I couldn't believe how slow they were," which is a great thing. But they weren't so quick like we come to see forwards now. And Michael, in the book, you mentioned things changed towards the end of the 20th century, and enter Anelka and Owen. And these were players, especially Michael Owen. It was just like a whippet, wasn't it? It was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, he was just ridiculous. Again, looking back, just incredibly fast. It was when strikers had started to become really fast and defenders hadn't really evolved to take account of that. If that makes
right.
sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a goal in particular he scored at Old Trafford against Manchester United where he's literally third favourite to get a ball between Schmeichel and I think Ronnie Johnson and just makes up about 10 yards on both of them and nips the ball into the goal.
Could have been the game he was sent off later.
It was, yes, for like a two-footed tackle.
That's right. He was full of energy and spilled over.
People always forget that Owen was kind of seen as a bit of a tearaway in his younger years, and people are like, "Oh, well, that's part of his game." Uh-huh. You know, if you take that away, you lose that from Owen's game. And Anelka as well, you know, a different kind of character, very kind of mysterious figure in those early days at Arsenal. Well, I suppose throughout his career, but particularly in those early days at Arsenal, no one really knew what he was all about. Almost acted in separation from the rest of the team, if that makes sense. It always running in behind, but scored some fantastic goals. There's one against Blackburn in particular where he rounded the goalkeeper and put it in. One where he streaked away in the FA Cup final against Newcastle to score. And I think that changed the way teams played. You know, when you had a combination of a number nine like Anelka and a number 10 like Bergkamp, almost pulling the defence in different directions. Before teams learned how to cope with that, generally by sitting deeper, you know, it was such a almost an easy way to get through on goal. Stick a through ball in behind and you'd have a quick striker running through. And, you know, Anelka and Owen were both absolutely prolific in their younger years.
Adam, you recently interviewed someone who encountered Michael Owen during his peak years, if you will.
Owen terrorised many a defender and goalkeeper, but there's a rather lesser known victim, which was Jamie, the goalkeeper from Michael Owen's video, Michael Owen's Soccer Skills.
Yeah.
It was around 98, 99, I believe it was released. And it's kind of gained this cult status over the years because there was this segment where Owen was essentially demonstrating how to finish in every possible way, and it was just this kind of ritual humiliation of this poor goalkeeper
with Neville Southall coaching
at just out of shot. There was a bit where someone was crossing the ball in and Owen was just literally hammering volleys from the edge of the 6-yard box at him, and that went on for an uncomfortable length of time. And then it progressed to one-on-ones, so he was chipping this kid.
It was so self-indulgent.
Yeah. And it got to the point where Owen curled one into the corner from the edge of the box.
But Owen was also self-commentating as well.
Yeah, this is quite a remarkable thing. I never really had... you don't really have many footballers down as this type of character. Certainly not an 18-year-old Michael Owen. He was really lauding it.
I mean, let's be honest.
Didn't know he had this much personality.
It was bordering on bullying.
It really was. It really was. So it got to the point where, he curled this ball into the corner past him and he'd already celebrated by pointing at his name on the back of his shirt, and then he wheeled away and celebrated this time and uttered the immortal, terrible words of "game, set and match, Owen."
Yeah.
And then he went, he wheeled away saying, "yeah," and then all you can hear after that is Neville Southall just out of shot, barely audible, "well done, he's 13
yeah,
perfect.
Is this man still haunted by this?
Yeah, I tracked him down via the delights of Facebook. Thanks a lot, social media. And he was slightly reluctant at first because he's like, "What am I letting myself in for?" I said, "No, it'd be brilliant." And it was brilliant to talk to him because, he was quite humble about the whole affair. And I detected a little bit of distaste towards Owen, but I think he got over it over the years. But this kid is I wouldn't say he's mentally scarred, but he's certainly not a professional goalkeeper anymore.
Oh my goodness, yeah. I mean, Owen was, it's easy to forget, but in his early days was so good, wasn't he? And so quick. I mean, I think it was Lee Dixon found that out in the FA Cup final. But this emphasis upon speed prompted Arsenal to buy arguably the Premier League's most celebrated striker in Thierry Henry, Michael.
Yeah, he was essentially a replacement for Anelka. Arsenal famously sold Anelka for $23 million and for that bought Henry and essentially paid for their new training ground, which proved one of the best deals in Premier League history. Yeah. Henry was an incredible player. I think sometimes people forget how raw he was when he came. He was kind of a left winger who scored some goals rather than a ruthless centre forward.
He had a brilliant time at Juventus.
No, although, interestingly, I kind of read a lot of interviews with him and... you know, as research for this section, and he insists that he actually played quite well for Juve, and he just saw an opportunity at Arsenal and wanted to work with Wenger, who, you know, had brought him through at Monaco. And the thing you get when you watch old Henry tapes is just the variety of goals he scored. He could run in behind, of course, but he was so good at coming deep and linking play. He scored, you know, Panenka penalties. He scored a back heel against Charlton. He scored quickly taken free kicks. He was a very kind of cheeky player, I think, Henry.
But he didn't get many headers, though. This is one of those moments where you see a real change, a bit of a sea change in the centre-forward style. Yes, it was happening before that, but this is when it was quite obvious. Here was a guy who was really a winger, who was a converted forward. And I can remember being at Highbury once, actually, and Henry scored a header, and someone, "Oh, that's the first header he scored in the league," or something like that. Yeah. I thought, he's been here for ages. Now, for English football fans used to the Shearers, even Ferguson's and Dion Dublin's, you know, when Henry came along, it's a very different style of centre-forward play, Adam.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for all his considerable repertoire of goals. My abiding image of Thierry Henry is this kind of relentless, running down the left channel, waiting for the goalkeeper to make a decision, and quite casually curling it past him into the bottom right corner. Mm-hmm. And this seemed to happen time and time and time again. But you're right, there is a lingering English obsession with devastating headers from balls into the box. And he was never going to offer that. But as we've established, around the turn of the century, there was this obsession with pace. And it affected strikers a lot more than defenders could react to it. So he was at that cutting edge of that, where he took it on from just pure pace, but he had this dead-eyed, clinical finishing in front of goal. So he combined those two things, and defenders hadn't evolved enough to react to it.
Henry became one of the, as you said, the most celebrated and popular strikers in the Premier League history, and one of the best goal scorers, part of the invincible side as well. You know, he played in different Arsenal sides than we're used to today, but played in one not too similar to what Arsene Wenger has been so used to playing in recent years. And other sides try to get similar players as well. We're looking at, say, the likes of Cissé and Diouf and David Bellion, dare we suggest as well. And people did think of converting these wingers into forwards, didn't they?
Yeah, it was interesting to go through some of the... just look at the starting 11s at this point in the Premier League. You had a situation that I don't think you would have before or after, where managers were playing two pacey strikers up front together. So you would have sometimes Henry was partnered by Sylvain Viltord, which in this day I think wouldn't work because defences play so deep that you'd say, well, that's a bit one-dimensional. Liverpool as well, I think, had Cissé and... Oh, sorry, they had Diouf and Owen up front together at the same point, which again I don't think you'd see before or after. So yeah, there was such an obsession with pace, and I think it took a while before defences really reacted to that and played deeper. And indeed, you know, defenders themselves became a lot quicker to deal with that, because they were no longer just coping with aerial threat, they were coping with stuff going in behind as well.
Manchester United, they didn't really follow suit, because they had Ruud van Nistelrooy, Adam, a very different player, but equally a wonderful goal scorer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact stat, but we're talking about a player who scored almost the majority of his goals inside the penalty area.
That's right.
This isn't a guy who's going to... He did it once or twice, quite notably, but this isn't a guy who's going to get the ball on the halfway line and then 10 seconds later he's going to stick it in the back of the net. He relied on service, but then when that service came in, he was the ultimate guy to have in the middle, because he was a superb finisher. An oddly rare example of a guy who could translate Eredivisie form to the Premier League, whereas Matej Kezman, for example, mm-hmm. perhaps didn't. So I don't know how much of a gamble it was. You know, it was about 19 million they paid for him.
Yeah.
He'd just done his knee, I think, so the first time they tried to sign him, then he did his knee and they came back for him. So I suppose it was a bit of a shot in the dark for them to go with him. But I think he hit the ground running straight away, scored in his debut against Fulham at Old Trafford, and he didn't really look back. So perhaps he could have stayed longer at Old Trafford.
Well, Van Nistelrooy is a curious one, Michael, because you wouldn't have thought that a striker like him may have such a prominent role at a club the size of Manchester United these days, because he was kind of like just a number nine, really.
I mean, he was one-dimensional. I think he's... The book charts, obviously, the development of tactics throughout the Premier League era, and it's basically about players becoming more all-rounders. And Van Nistelrooy was essentially very one-dimensional. He was good at one thing. He was probably better at that one thing than anyone in Premier League history, but basically got left behind because he didn't have the ability to link play, the ability to get assists. He wasn't really a team player, actually. He was quite an individualist. But it's interesting to go back, and if you look at some accounts of the time where people have compared Henry and Van Nistelrooy, a lot of people at that point were saying Van Nistelrooy was the better player, the better striker, because he was good in the air. Whereas that seems slightly ludicrous now, because we're so used to strikers being all-rounders like Henry. Mm-hmm. They're mobile, they're quick, they can link play. But we were still, you know, it was almost a little bit like the same way we were thinking left-wingers had to be left-footed. We were still thinking strikers had to be good in the air. And I think Henry was probably the man who kind of helped to change that.
Yeah, I think the people who may call themselves purists, perhaps traditionalists, would side with Van Nistelrooy in those times, because that's what they came to expect. There's a man who stands in the middle of the pitch, in the box, gets on the end of the crosses, thank you very much, you know. And someone like Henry, hang on a minute, what's he doing out there? That's messing with the symmetrical dimensions of football, and so on and so forth. But as the years went on, it was the Henri kind of type of striker more than the Van Nistelrooy that we've seen more and more of. And more recently, the popularity of what we call the false nine now, which a number of years ago people thought, what on earth are you talking about? But of course, it's a term that's bandaged around quite happily. And this is partly in response to Lionel Messi's tremendous performances for Barcelona. Michael, has the false nine taken off in England, do you think?
Yes and no. I mean, the interesting thing in terms of the term itself was, I remember when I first started writing for The Guardian, you had to put that in inverted commas, false nine. Whereas now it's just false nine. You're that's a legitimate football term. Has it taken off? I'm not sure it's really been particularly successful in the way that Messi played it. I think there's a case to be said that too many teams were trying to replicate a role played by the greatest player we've ever seen, and that's why it didn't work. But if you look at some of the players who've won the Golden Boot over the last 5 or 6 years, Carlos Tevez, Robin Van Persie, Sergio Aguero, Luis Suarez, when they came to English football, they were considered second strikers or number 10s. Mm-hmm. But because the concept of the strikers changed, and now, you know, you don't have your Van Nistelrooy as your goal poachers, those players are now what we come to expect as the highest player at the pitch. They can score goals, but they can also link play, and they can do both, you know, equally well. So the false nine, I think, has influenced what we think of as centre forwards rather than the centre forwards becoming false nines.
Yeah, Adam, do you think that type of forward now, as Michael says, you know, the false nine and so on, that more all-round play, do you think players have developed and gone through youth systems where that is the case, so they've become those types of players? Or do you think that changing of the centre forward position has just accommodated for that? You know, sometimes we see with fullbacks, you look at fullbacks from yesterday and you think, oh, they're essentially trying to burst forward and they're kind of defensive wingers, but they were never really given license, whereas now they are. Do you think that's the same with centre forwards? Do you think that some of these players just think, oh, it's almost like you've been waiting years for this to happen, and then suddenly they can, if you know what I mean?
I'd be amazed if any false nine grew up being a false nine. Mm. I mean, the classic Premier League goal scorer's story is that, you know, as a 13, 14 year old, they were scoring 80 goals a season for whichever youth team they were playing for, and 90% of those would have been running over the top and smacking it in because they were quicker than everyone else. False nines seem to me to be kind of just a natural case of tactical cat and mouse. Defences have evolved to try and deal with a certain threat, so managers have had to come up with a new way of doing it. So it's almost like how, I don't know, a virus adapts to a vaccine. So it seems like a natural way of teams trying to unlock the door a different way. Strikers don't often have to, I haven't historically had to work hard tactically. They knew what their job was, they knew where they had to be on the pitch. So this is a new one for these players because, you know, they've had to really think about where they position themselves. Normally they go where the ball goes. Now they've had to consider themselves part of a whole collective rather than their own individual job.
It's interesting to look at some players, say like Thierry Henry. I mean, years ago, Michael, would he have just been a winger? And that would have been the end of the story. You know, would Carlos Tevez been asked to just stay in the box and get on the end of crosses? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, there has been a big evolution. I think another interesting player, if you look at how teams are playing at the moment, is Roberto Firmino, who's become Liverpool's first-choice centre-forward, with Klopp having ditched Benteke, who's an absolutely classic number nine, old-school number nine, and, as I mentioned earlier, Sturridge. And the one thing Firmino is probably not top-class at as a centre-forward is scoring goals. He's brilliant at linking play. He can dribble, he can pass. He can certainly press, which is, you know, maybe Klopp's main thing. But he's probably not going to be a 20-goal-a-season striker. And that's, you know, I guess the shift is not just about the strikers, but about the team. And the goals now have to be spread from attacking midfielders, wide players, not just the centre-forward. So it's been there's almost been a kind of merging of different roles between number 10s, wide players, centre forwards, and you have these players like Firmino who are essentially all rounders who just happen to be playing as a central forward.
And I suppose, Adam, instead of that one man just getting on the end of something, you attack as a unit.
Yes.
It's almost like you talk about a front four or a front five, and you include some midfielders in that, of course. Just to sort of finish, what category does Harry Kane fall into?
He's obviously the next stage of the evolution of the Premier League striker, but it seems we're not entirely sure about what pigeonhole he fits into, because the easiest answer to that question is that he simply does a lot of things quite well. He isn't particularly quick, but he's quick enough to evade most Premier League defenders. He's not a battering ram, but he's incredibly strong. He's not a dead-eyed finisher like, say, Van Nistelrooy. He's not an opportunist poacher in the middle, but he's a very, very good finisher. He strikes the ball very well. He's got this almost Hasselbank-esque penchant for shooting whenever he gets the opportunity, which I really admire, because that's what strikers should do. If you've got the ball and you can see the goal, just give it a whack.
It's a fair point. I mean, could he become, Michael, as he develops, a bit more like a Wayne Rooney, where some people think, oh, where do we play him? You know, with Rooney,
yeah,
I mean...
I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, the funny thing with him is, when he was first breaking through at Tottenham, I saw him compared to both Alan Shearer and Teddy Sheringham. Well, and yeah. from a 90s perspective, they were the classic, you know, played up front for England together brilliantly at Euro 96 because they were different types of players. Sheringham dropped off. There was like the Teddy Sheringham role, wasn't there? Because no one else played that role.
That's right.
And there's also the Teddy Sheringham run because no one else went to the near post. Anything slightly unusual with Teddy Sheringham.
Imagine having a corner named after you.
Yeah, exactly.
Glamour.
But the fact that he was being compared to both just sums up how he's like an all-rounder. And I think that probably sums up what a number nine is these days. They're not a number nine like Shearer just going in behind. He's not a player like Sheringham who's definitely a second striker. Mm-hmm. He is somewhere in between. He kind of merges the two. And I must admit, it took me a while to really be convinced by Harry Kane because he's such a strange player to get to grips with. Mm-hmm. A little bit like Thomas Müller of Bayern. You're not quite sure what he excels at, but he's got a lot of things that he's very good at. And more than anything else, positionally, he's in the right place at the right time, which is maybe the most traditional attribute of a striker.
He's a 9.5.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, perhaps. But like I say, Rooney's not been that dissimilar. Rooney's played off Michael Owen for country before, and yet has played been right up top for Manchester United. He's been a difficult one to pigeonhole, and some people still, obviously he's in a different stage of his career now, Adam, but some people are still not sure where his best position was even back in the day.
The Rooney's problem was, even when he was 18 and his barnstorming best when he was just a bull, there was always this assumption that later in his career he would go back and just become Paul Scholes, and it would be fine. It turns out he's not physically or technically capable of doing that. I don't think Harry Kane isn't lumbering under the same assumptions. He's too good a striker, and he's not kind of a diminutive playmaker looking sort. He's too tall, so I suspect he will continue to plough that furrow, whatever it is he's doing, for a long time. It'd be interesting to see where the potential is for his demise. He does too many things too well for one thing to kind of fade. He doesn't rely on his pace, and he's had injuries, but he seems to bounce back from them quite quickly. And so the only mystery about him is where he came from and how he did it so quickly.
Which perhaps this isn't the podcast to answer that question.
I wasn't casting aspersions in case the lawyers listening. Sorry, Harry.
Indeed, where did they grow him? Yeah. That's what we want to know. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Mixer podcast. Michael Cox is the Mixer, the story of Premier League tactics from Route 1 to False 9 is out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. I'm Marcus Speller. Thanks very much to Michael Cox and Adam Hurry for joining me. Please join us next time for our final episode, where we'll be turning our attention to the managers.